Funding for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer is provided by Hawaiian Legacy Reforestation Initiative.
I'm Tom Wilmer. Come along and join me as we continue our exploration of Northeast Nebraska, a realm of never-ending surprises. Niobrara State Park is located on a blufftop overlooking the confluence of the mighty Missouri and the Niobrara Rivers. What makes the setting distinctive is that it's one of the rarely found last remaining free-flowing segments of the Missouri River. The mile-wide section is much as Lewis and Clark would have witnessed back in 1804, and they camped right here. Join National Park Ranger John Rokas as he shares his insights and passions for the river and the region.
Lewis and Clark were here. They came through here in 1804 and back downstream in 1806.
Family farming has been a tough row to hoe for most Nebraskans for a very long time. For those who cannot evolve and change with the times, family farming and ranching quickly becomes an unprofitable exercise. But for those like the Krajicek family who've been farming and ranching in Nebraska for more than a century, they've maintained a viable ranching model by including eco-ranch tours on board a tractor-pulled covered wagon. The family raises elk, buffalo, cows, and goats for meat, as well as offering seasonal elk hunts for the sportsmen from around the country and overseas. Under the watchful eye of Mom, Chris Krajicek, her daughter Stacy and her husband, along with Stacy's brother and sister-in-law Allison, run every aspect of daily life on the farm, from feeding and doctoring the herds to fencing, repairing, driving tractors, and much more. Come along and join Stacy Krajicek Miller at Krajicek Elk and Buffalo Ranch in Niobrara, Nebraska.
Well, we are the third generation to own the place. And like I said, my dad, you know, he went hunting for the elk and then he wanted to raise his own.
Ponca State Park, like Niobrara, is set on the flanks of the wild and scenic portion of the Missouri River. Ponca is a one-stop destination for families and especially extended family retreats. With an array of new upscale cabins and old classic screen porch cottages in the woods, Ponca is anchored by the Missouri National Recreational River Resource and Education Center, with funding by Ponca's two main partners, the Corps of Engineers and the National Park Service. Main attractions at Ponca include hiking, biking, golf, archery, and of course, kayaking and canoeing on the Missouri. Join Jeff Fields, Nebraska Game and Park Superintendent at Ponca State Park, and Tyler Wolf, Assistant Superintendent.
We've been expanding some of our winter activities to include some events. We have an event called Winterfest that we do right after Christmas.
And then it's time to cross the river and step into Iowa territory for a visit with Dean Knutson, Museum Curator at the DeSoto Wildlife and National Refuge, located in Missouri Valley, Iowa. In addition to an extensive wildlife interpretive center, a highlight of the facility is the showcase of pristine condition frayed artifacts from the riverboat Bertrand that sunk on the Missouri back in 1865. The wreckage was found and recovered in the 1960s, with 90% of its freight in showroom new condition due to the anaerobic conditions of the silt and mud on the river bottom.
There's a French champagne that was on board, brandied peaches, even some sardines that were imported from Europe.
And then it's a visit with Nancy Gillis in Bancroft, Nebraska, at the John Neihardt State Historical Site. Neihardt's incredible lifetime achievements are chronicled and showcased, and his legacy remains ensured by being honored as Nebraska's Poet Laureate in perpetuity.
He was a journalist. He made his living writing literary criticisms, and then on the side was writing his great epic Cycle of the West, which took him 29 years to write.
My name is John Rokas, and I'm a national park ranger. We're here at Niobrara State Park, one of the partners of Missouri National Recreational River.
Tell us about what you are most proud of, why somebody should come here, and what they should see and do.
Wow. This is one of the great viewpoints over the Missouri River, and we're talking the real Missouri River. We're not talking man-made lakes. We're not talking man-made barge canals. We're talking about free-flowing segments of the Missouri River.
So not only is this a view that Lewis and Clark might have witnessed, but they were here, right?
Lewis and Clark were here. They came through here in 1804 and back downstream in 1806. They actually camped at one point at the confluence of the Niobrara and the Missouri River, which we are overlooking right now.
And did they journal this area? Is there documentation?
They did document this in their journals. Lewis commented on the sediment coming out of the Niobrara River. They also looked for the Ponca tribe here, but they apparently were out buffalo hunting at the time.
So then they moved on.
Lewis and Clark kept going, and they actually set up their fort. They call Fort Mandan in the neighborhood of the Mandan and Hidatsa tribes in what is now North Dakota. So they actually spent their first winter in a larger city than St. Louis, where they started.
Wow. Interesting. John, thank you so much.
Thank you for coming to visit the parks.
You're welcome.
Now let's join Stacy Krajcek Miller at the Krajcek Elk and Buffalo Ranch in Niobrara, Nebraska.
Stacy, this was your dad's vision?
This was. He loved the animals, and so he wanted to raise them. And people loved to come see the animals, and so he loved to show them. So that's why we started the tours.
Did you get your first elk and the buffalo at the same time?
No, we got the elk first about 30 years ago, and the buffalo probably about 4 or 5 years later.
With the elk, the ultimate intent or viability of it was for hunting, right?
Well, it started out with the velvet
okay,
antler,
right,
actually.
Right. Did he have that idea before he got the elk, or was it an epiphany afterwards?
It was just a hobby. He just loved the animal. Mm-hmm. He just loved the animal. And then after we got him, we learned that the velvet was worth money. So then we started in raising more because of that. And then a year before we started the tours, we did start hunting.
But if you didn't have your hunting, you probably still would be worth doing just for the velvet alone, right?
Right now, the velvet market is not as high as it was when we first got into it. It would still just be kind of a hobby. A lot of guys that are raising them now, if they're not doing tours or hunting, it's not really worth raising the elk if you don't just love them.
And the hunting aspect of it, that makes it worthwhile too, then.
Yeah.
Another ingredient.
Right. And it is a lot of fun to meet the different hunters. We've had them from Poland and Japan and Mexico. It's kind of a lot of work. We do the butchering, but it's rewarding. It's fun. So,
what sort of fee? What would somebody pay to go on an elk hunt?
Well, they don't have to have a license or a permit because we own the animals. It's a two-day hunt, and it just goes by the score.
Mm-hmm.
So, and all the prices are on our website at KSK, Big Game Outfitters.
And what would it include? Would they spend the night here, or would they go to town? Or?
There's our neighbors have a lodge over here, and so we put them up there. Mm-hmm. They stay there, and they come and eat all their meals with us. It's a two-day guaranteed hunt. If it takes 3 days, it takes 3 days.
Right.
Or we've even had a guy that come, and he got his hunt, and we butchered it, and he stayed for the whole week because he likes us so much.
Oh, right. That's great.
Yeah.
And like you said, a lot of people from Europe and around the world. So this is a really an exotic Wild West experience for them, isn't it?
Yeah, I guess it is.
Mm-hmm.
It's a lot of fun. So.
Yeah, coming from Germany would be very different.
Yes. Those guys from Poland, they were a lot of fun. You know, listening to them talk, you know, the different things that they were. A dentist. He was a dentist in Poland. And, you know, it was just, the different walks of life is just fun to see, so.
I bet. Well, tell us a little bit more about the buffalo. As we both know, it's such a lean meat that a person on a meat-restricted diet can eat it.
Yes. The elk and buffalo are both very, the buffalo meat market is growing. You know, it's in high demand. So we are feeding them, and then we feed them out, and then we take them to Pierce, Colorado, and that's where they get slaughtered there. The benefits of the bison, they're technically called bison. You know, it's just for the leanness of it. You know, beef is good, but you got the extra fat with it, so.
The buffalo meat market, I presume, it has to be a growing market, a growing industry.
It is. Where we take it to Pierce, Colorado, those people own 3 slaughter plants, and so sometimes they'll even pay the trucking because they're
that motivated.
Yeah, they're low. You know, they're not getting them in, so.
Mm-hmm.
And there are so many more healthy, conscious people in all over, you know, in the United States that it's growing that way because the demand is just really growing for it.
Well, let's talk about cooking buffalo meat for a moment, because there are a couple tricks to not having that. One of the downsides is you can wind up with a tough burger.
You can.
Yeah,
you
so
can.
We know the secret. Share it.
Yeah. We always cook it slower. Sometimes if it's, you know, like the hamburger, if it's a little dry, if you want it more juicy, maybe mix a little olive oil with it, or, you know, like with the roast. We do a lot of slow cookers, you know.
So
with the
slower
roast.
And lower temperature.
Yeah,
then.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Marinating the steaks, you know, that's always a good thing. We've had different marinades. Hunters, they always come and they all have their own recipes that, oh, this works good and this works good. So we've tried a lot of different things, but, I mean, that always helps too, but that's the trick, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, tell us a little bit about the family history of your farm here in Nebraska.
Well, we are the third generation to own the place. And like I said, my dad, you know, he went hunting and then for the elk, and then he wanted to raise his own. But
so
you know,
it was his grandfather that started?
It was his uncle.
Okay.
His uncle had it. And then
and when did they settle here and where did they come from?
The Krajicks came from Czechoslovakia.
Okay.
They homesteaded across the river from us, and then they came, you know, the next generation came over here and bought land. And
so were the Krajicks originally homesteaders then in the first wave of settlers?
Uh-huh. Right. And then, and we started, Dad started out, you know, it was more the farming, and they had cattle in the feedlots.
Okay. Was he doing corn too?
Yeah, corn and beans and Milo. You know, you don't see much Milo around anymore, but, yep, hay. And back then, you know, the equipment wasn't as big, and we had a lot more guys working for us. Now we have more land, but bigger equipment and less people. We only have one hired man.
Wow, interesting shift. In the barns here, did you have a milking barn?
No milk cows. There was hogs. Mm-hmm. Hogs, and we had chickens. Mother was scared to death of chickens, so we never had chickens again.
That's funny. Part of the reason, I presume, for the buffalo and the elk has to do with a shift in a farm, as a family farm, of survival, doesn't it? Finding different markets, different viable ways of surviving.
Right. Well, when my brother, when he graduated from high school, then he went to college, and Mom told him, you know, we have to have, you know, something else to support another income.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so... the tours did work good. You know, we had the bus that wanted to come, and we said, you know, here's our opportunity. You know, people are interested. We should start charging for this. So that was just the year after we started with the hunting. And Dad and Steve were big hunters, and so it just kind of all fell into place.
And you still do the tours?
We still do the tours. Mm-hmm. This is our 19th year of tours.
Nice. Covered wagon pulled by a tractor.
Yes, yeah. Mm-hmm. Some people come and they want to know why they're not pulled by horses, but we say horses are not going to pull 30 people up a hill in a wagon like that. So, yep, it's just more efficient.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so the survival of the Krajicek family farm has to do with tours, with buffalo, with elk, and what else?
Beef cattle.
Beef cattle.
We run 200 head of beef cows. Mm-hmm. We calve them out. And then we have goats. Steve and Allison like the goats.
And
so
that's meat goat?
Yep, they're a Spanish boar goat. Yep, we have them and the farming, and yeah, it keeps us busy.
Mm-hmm. Very cool. All right. Well, for further information, I bet you have a website.
We do. It's NebraskaElkTours.com, and we have a Facebook page that I try to keep pretty current on, post videos and pictures on it regularly. So, yeah, come and visit us. Come and see us.
The sister-in-law and you and everybody, you're all ranch hands too, aren't you?
We are. We say if you can jump high and run fast, then you'll survive here. So my name is Stacy Krajicek Miller, and we are at Krajicek Elk and Buffalo Ranch at Nyborough, Nebraska, and our website is NebraskaElkTours.com.
Stacy, thank you so much. What a wonderful day to visit your farm.
Yes, thank you for coming.
I'm Tom Wilmer reporting from Ponca State Park in Nebraska. We're with Tyler Wolf, Assistant Superintendent, and Jeff Field, Superintendent for the Parks Division. Hi, guys.
Hello, how are you?
Good.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Tell us about, first of all, some of the cool things to do here at Ponca State Park.
Well, being right along the banks of the Missouri River, and this section of the river is called the Missouri National Recreational River, you've got the old Missouri River, so you can go out and experience kind of what The old river, as Lewis and Clark might have saw it 200 years ago, you can see the sandbars, the snags out on the river, the undefined wide channel. It gives you a unique perspective of that.
Some of the other areas are channelized and controlled, right?
Correct. This will be the first section of the old Missouri River you're going to see coming from St. Louis. Okay. That's kind of what the focus of our park is. We've got, you know, as far as the park itself, it's 2,300 acres, a lot of eastern deciduous forest, lots of trails, cabins, swimming pool. It's kind of a resort-type atmosphere we have here. So that's one of the things we offer.
And you have a range from very rustic, simple cottages to some pretty upscale ones, don't you?
Right. We have our four-bedroom mini lodges, as we call them, that we just added about 4 or 5 years ago. And they're more of a group-style cabin, kind of new to our parks division, where we're targeting multi-families, multi-couples to stay and as a group.
Mm-hmm. And yet your other ones are screened in, rustic, almost log-sided cottages.
Right, and mm-hmm. we call them our rustic cabins as opposed to our old cabins. sounds a little better anyway, but they're the old knotty pine inside. They're what you typify as an old cabin in the woods, I guess.
And they're quite affordable, aren't they?
Yeah, they're just under $100, mm-hmm. so.
Tell us about some of the things that we would do and see here.
We have a very active outdoor educational program here, from nature trails and hikes, newly constructed shooting range, which involves shotgun range, .22, muzzleloading, archery, addle-addle, slingshot, tomahawk, and a pellet gun range. Obviously, kayaking and canoeing along the Missouri River here. Great fishing and hunting opportunities with 2,300 acres. We do hay rack tours for the general public, a wide variety of outdoor activities for families and reunions to enjoy here at the park.
And back to kayaking, you do canoeing for families? Or?
We do. We have a program where we take families and individuals out in our backwaters, which is basically a chute off the mainstream in the Missouri River, which dead ends. It has, you know, very little to no flow through it, which is very safe, large diversity of plant species and wildlife to view in those areas.
And what happens in the winter here, the middle of the winter?
Actually, that's kind of a new thing for us. We're up to about our mini lodges, which are year-round facilities. We weren't really known to be a year-round destination, and so we've been expanding some of our winter activities to include some events. We have an event called Winterfest that we do right after Christmas. We do some holiday programming on weekends for guests in our cabins. And then we groom cross-country ski trails. We have a sledding hill, so we try to do as much as we can. Hopefully Mother Nature cooperates with some snow every now and then.
And there was a golf course as we were driving in. Is that yours?
It is, in a way. It's our property. We have a lease for the city, which has a board that manages the golf course, a 9-hole golf course with a driving range just across the road from it.
Some of the people that come stay here at the different lodge facilities, they might also golf.
Yep. Both of us benefit. It's a win-win situation for us as well as the golf course. Many of our park users go over there and enjoy the golf course and vice versa.
Talk to us about your main lodge. This is quite a little headquarters facility, isn't it?
Yeah, it's the Missouri National Recreational River Resource and Education Center, which is a mouthful, but named accordingly, as I mentioned earlier, of our location of the eastern gateway to the Missouri Rec River. But it was funded in part, a lot of different partners. Our two main partners are two federal agencies that manage that section of river, Corps of Engineers and National Park Service. And an interpretive display wing that we have here that showcases all the natural, cultural history of the Rec River was built and designed by the National Park Service. So they have a lot of input here, and they've been on that part of the river that they manage. It's nice to have them as a partner.
In your location, you're right on the Missouri River. When you look at the other shore, that's a whole other state.
We have a location here in the park we call the Three-State Overlook. And when you look right across the river, you can see South Dakota, and you look off on the horizon, see the bluff, the other bluff, and that's actually looking into Iowa.
For the traveler, say somebody was coming on Interstate 80, for example, cross country, and they wanted to divert and spend a day or two here, where are you located relative to somebody coming across the country?
Well, that's a good question. Coming off of I-80, what I would do if it was me personally traveling, I would somehow or another try to go through the sand hills. There's a lot of different ways to go through there.
And that's a great journey in itself.
Something you wouldn't want to miss, yep. Mm-hmm. And then I would take Highway 12, which is a scenic byway that'll lead you right to here.
About how long time would you plan on that?
I would plan probably 4 or 5 hours to do it right. You know, it depends on how many stops you make.
You might even want to spend the night in Valentine or something,
yeah,
right?
Valentine would be a great stop. That's kind of the other national river we have. The Niobrara River is focused there. So.
Yeah. I kayaked that one. That was great.
Yep. Yep. It's a neat river.
Okay. Anything else you guys want to add about the park and what you do, what you're most proud of?
Well, one thing I failed to mention at the beginning, our slogan, so to speak, or theme of the park is where people, nature, meet. It's a destination where people, families can get together and be families along with learning about the outdoors. And we offer, as Tyler was saying, lots and lots of opportunities for families to learn and experience the outdoors. And that's really what we're about as a park, what we're about as an agency, Nebraska Game Parks Commission. So.
Very, very cool. Tyler Wolf, thank you.
Thank you.
And Jeff Field, superintendent. What a pleasure. Thanks for sharing.
Yep, thank you for coming.
All right. I'm Tom Wilmer, reporting from Ponca State Park in Nebraska.
My name is Dean Knudsen. I'm a museum curator with the Fish and Wildlife Service, and I'm based here at the Visitor Center at DeSoto Wildlife National Refuge.
And it's more than a wildlife refuge because you have an incredible steamship that sunk in its relics right here.
Yeah, we have a built-in wow factor here. When people walk in, they don't expect to see artifacts off of a steamboat that was recovered back in the late 1960s. This boat sank in 1865.
So they found it in the 60s then, right?
Yeah, almost 100 years later. And we're coming up on the 150th anniversary of when the boat sank. Next year we'll mark that date.
And this was a freighter primarily, wasn't it?
Yes, cargo carrier. Mm-hmm. It did have about a dozen passengers on board, but its main mission was to carry cargo.
And it was en route to the gold fields in Montana?
In Montana, right. And she probably was going to make stops along the way at Sioux City and various other river ports. But her primary destination was a gold rush community up in central Montana.
As far as I know, there's only this facility and then the Arabia in Kansas City where you can see a literal boatload of freight that's 150 years old that's in mint condition.
That is right. There are other wrecks that have been excavated, but none have had the quality of the cargo preservation as we have had.
And do you think it was primarily a function of the siltation and the anaerobic mud conditions in which it was entombed?
Absolutely. A lot of it is just maybe good luck, the proper conditions. Others might have been the condition of the boat when it sank, you know, if it was on fire or if there was a boiler explosion or something. The cargo might have been damaged or salvors might have gotten it off.
Give us a word picture of what you have that people can see. I mean, right in front of us, there's a coffee grinder, two of them, that brand new almost.
Yeah. Anything that you would have needed to set up a home or a business up in the Montana frontier can be found on this boat. Tools, clothing, food, just about anything that you can imagine.
Paradoxically, not only what you would find in a pioneer frontier home, but you would find in a home in Cincinnati.
Yeah, there's cut glass candy dishes here, imported china from England. There's a French champagne that was on board. Brandied peaches, even some sardines that were imported from Europe. Those things would have been for those lucky few that actually found gold, I imagine, or maybe used by the merchants who made money by selling these things to the miners.
Right. And tell us some more of the cool things that you think are really exceptional.
Oh, goodness, where does one start?
I know. What? There's a bullwhip.
Yeah, there's probably a story behind that. We have some cowbells here as well, so they were probably anticipating maybe dairy herds or something like that to make money. Cooking utensils. Personal items from passengers on board. There's a black lacquer box with Chinese markings on it that had once held, we think, a kimono. So either a souvenir of a trip or maybe a servant girl, maybe even perhaps. We're not sure about that. There are a lot of mysteries on board. We don't even know where the name Bertrand comes from. The sister ships for this riverboat were all named after river towns or gold mine towns, but the Bertrand, we're not sure where that came from.
And let's dig a little deeper on the breadth of the inventory that was on this vessel. And we're looking at the equivalent of a whole store, retail operation here. This is not just a handful or a few boxes.
No, I sometimes say this is like a floating Walmart. Just about anything that you can think of is available here, and some things that you might not even think of. Buttons were important back in the 19th century. There were no zippers or Velcro back then, and so if you lose a button on your clothing, you might be really hurting. So there were thousands of replacement buttons on board, sewing kits, candle molds.
Right across from us, there are spigots of some sort that you would put in a bunghole in a barrel.
Yeah, a lot of saloon goods here. There are really nice, heavy glass shot glasses. There are even ledger books for businessmen up there. Probably the saloon keepers would have needed to keep them. Kerosene lamps, hats, coats, shirts.
Talk to us for a moment about the leather, the felt, the fabrics, and how they were able to remain in showroom new condition.
We have a lot of leather work boots that are just as supple now as when they were manufactured, and part of that is due to the tannic acid that resisted any kind of decay, and the other part is that they were just sealed up within the silt and sand. Oxygen couldn't get to them, and so they didn't decay. And they're just as pliable now as when they were new. We have rubber raincoats that still smell of the rubber.
Goodyear?
Goodyear, yes, manufactured by Goodyear. And what else do we have? My goodness. Shirts. We even have some children's shoes. I'm not sure how large a market there would have been in a mining town for children's shoes, but maybe they were meant for along the way for trade goods or something. Cooking items, coffee pots, frying pans. We even have two waffle irons on board, cast iron waffle irons, wash tubs, buckets. It just goes on and on, you know, hammer, nail, full carpenter kits, just amazing things.
This is a look back in time that is uncanny because the inventory, the items that you have are fresher and newer than what you would see in any antique store.
Yeah, and we can date them to a precise time. When this boat sank on April 1st, 1865, the Civil War had just more than a week to go for Lee's surrender at Appomattox, and Abraham Lincoln still had 2 weeks to live. So that kind of sets the stage for the time and place and intention for these items. This is the lifestyle that people were living then. And one of the other remarkable things is that we have a walk-in cooler full of organic materials that came off this boat. We have butter, maple syrup, tallow, even nuts like hazelnuts and peanuts that were intended for sale upriver, sardines. I know I'm leaving lots of things out, but things that survived 100 years.
Mm-hmm. That still look as they did. In Arabia, I saw, I think, a jar of pickles. And
yeah.
There they were.
Yeah, we have pickles, too. They're not the pickles that we're used to today with cucumbers. They're made of okra. And most any other vegetable that they put into a brine, they call it a pickle. Nowadays, we just think of like dill pickles and that sort of thing. But we have brandied peaches that still look palatable. I'm not sure I'd recommend it. But canned corn, canned tomatoes, canned peaches were popular back then. Lots of baking powder, baking soda. They probably had flour on board. You know, that probably didn't survive more than just a couple days underwater. I could rattle on forever, I think.
All right. Dean, if somebody were visiting Nebraska, how do they get here and when's the best time to come and tell us about for further information?
Well, we're located about 30 miles north of Omaha, and we're on Highway 30 between Missouri Valley, Iowa, and Blair, Nebraska. We're located in a visitor center at DeSoto National Wildlife Refuge. Relatively easy to find. We're open year-round, closed on the main federal holidays, of course, but we're open from 8:30 in the morning till 4:30 in the evening, you know, basically 7 days a week. Our peak visitation times are when we have the wildlife migrations in the fall and then again in the spring. But during the summer, we get a lot of good general tourism as well. We even get tour buses and that sort of thing that stop by. A lot of school groups come out and visit us. We also have a wide diversity in terms of our visitation, and we ask everyone to come out and see us. And if you want to learn a little bit more about us, we also have our own website, and we're on Facebook. You can see what's going on here.
And your website is?
Google, just type in DeSoto Wildlife Refuge, or if you want to get specific, it's DESO.FWS.
Excellent. Dean Knutson, thank you so much for sharing. What a pleasure.
My pleasure, too. I hope you come out and see us.
Hear the steamboat whistle call and better grab my bags and get on board. Got to go and seek my fortune. Can't lay around here.
My name is Nancy Gillis, and we are here at the John Neihardt State Historic Site in Bancroft, Nebraska. John Neihardt is Nebraska's poet laureate in perpetuity. He's probably the best known for Black Elk Speaks, which is the life story of the Lakota holy man, Black Elk. However, he wrote many, many other pieces, some 25 books having to do with the early West, particularly the fur trade and the rendezvous system, and then also books about the Lakota, books about the Omaha Indians, and lyric poetry.
Let's go back in time. We were talking earlier before we started recording about the time when he was born and what the world was like out in the West and the points in history.
Neihardt was born in 1881 and lived until 1973. So living in Kansas and Nebraska at that time, he was born not long after the battle at the Little Bighorn. He was 9 years old when the massacre at Wounded Knee took place. He was a young adult during World War I. This was a man who was very interested in America's epic history, and he had lived part of it.
And then parallel life with Black Elk, and when he was alive, what was going on?
Right. Black Elk was born in 1863 and lived until 1950. So Black Elk had been at the Little Bighorn Battle. He was also at the massacre at Wounded Knee and lived until 1950, so he saw World War I and World War II before he passed away.
That's probably one of the most incredible periods of history for anybody to have been alive, isn't it?
Oh, yes. Neihardt felt that the early 20th century was probably the most important time in American history. Mm-hmm. And he felt that the early 19th century was where we got the sense of being an American. The courage, the fortitude that showed itself in later years in World War I and World War II and later, he felt that came out of that early 1800s.
Tell us a little bit more about Neihardt's life and the things he did.
Well, he made a trip down the Missouri River in 1907 in a hand-built canoe and nearly lost his life, and they went without food. They met some very interesting people. He also had gone to college at age 13 and graduated in 4 years with 2 degrees. He taught himself Greek and Latin, and at Wayne Normal School in Wayne, Nebraska, the man who was the founder there, Dr. Kahn, said he had to stay up late at night to stay ahead of the young Neihardt for his classes the next day. He was a newspaper man. He was a journalist. He made his living writing literary criticisms, and then on the side was writing his great epic Cycle of the West, which took him 29 years to write. And in between that, he wrote Black Elk Speaks.
He was a dreamer, a visionary, and a mystic in some ways, wasn't he?
Yes, he was. He was an intensely spiritual man. He was what you might call an agnostic. He didn't believe in organized religion and in going to a church. But there is a level of spirituality and spiritual maturity in his poetry and in his writing that's very definitely there.
Nancy, thank you so much for sharing.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Yeah. For further information, the website?
Yes, it's neihardtcenter.org, and we also have a Facebook page. And just look up John G. Neihardt and read some of his fantastic material.
Nice. Thank you again.
The underbed music in this show was performed by Western fiddler Dave Rainwater, who played Civil War era tunes, Mike Beck, and Emmy Award winner David Holt.
He wants to get home. He wants to get home.
Funding for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer is provided by Hawaiian Legacy Reforestation Initiative.
Hawaiian Legacy Hardwoods and Four Seasons Resort Maui at Wailea invite you to sponsor a legacy tree and contribute to the biodiversity of Hawaii. Legacy trees can honor an individual, commemorate an event, or memorialize a loved one. Every tree dedication is a living legacy and a gift which grows grander year after year. The best time to plant a tree was 20 years ago. The second best time is now.
The Hawaiian Legacy Reforestation Initiative was awarded the 2014 EcoTour Operator of the Year by the Hawaiian Ecotourism Association. To learn more, visit legacytrees.org or call 1-877-707-TREE.
You've been listening to the Lowell Thomas Award-winning travel show, Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a weekly featured podcast on NPR.org, produced by California Central Coast NPR affiliate KCBX. Our San Francisco-based associate producer is Molly Blaisdell, covering the San Francisco Bay Area, the island of Maui, and the South Pacific. Our Wisconsin-based associate producer is Julie Henning, and Lauren Hayes is our technical assistant. Call you.